UV exposure can cause an array of harmful effects, such as sunburn, immune suppression, premature aging, precancerous changes, and even skin cancer. In order to help prevent skin cancer, dermatologists lead the way in providing strategies to their patients that will protect them from the harmful rays of the sun. In this dialogue, Dr. Henry Lim and Deputy Editor of Dialogues in Dermatology, Dr. Shadi Kharosh, walk us through an update on sunscreens.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. My name is Shadi Kharosh from the Dermatology Department at Massachusetts General Hospital, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Henry Lim, Chairman of the Dermatology Department at Henry Ford Hospital, world expert in photomedicine, and an expert contributor to the AAD and FDA panels on sunscreen. Dr. Lim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So today, we're here to talk about the question of SPF and FDA rulings, which have been current in the news. So to open up, could you please explain where this concept of SPF comes from scientifically?
SPF stands for sun protection factor. Essentially, it's a very good measurement of the protectiveness of sunscreen against the erythemogenic spectrum of sunlight. So that's predominantly UVA. UVA short wavelength UVA, which is UVA 2, and also the majority is UVB, which is the most important spectrum that causes sunburn. So it's UVB plus a small portion of UVA. This testing is very standardized by the FDA, that one has to apply 2 milligram per centimeter square of the sunscreen product on the skin, and then the skin would be exposed to the UVB as well as UVA to induce the erythema. It has been around for many, many years. It is used all over the world, and it is quite understood by most patients.
And I understand that in the news recently, there has been this question of FDA capping of sunscreens. Could you please explain for our listeners what that question means and what the relevant issues for dermatologists would be?
Sure. The FDA had come out with seeking comments, essentially, whether sunscreen should be capped at SPF 50, 50. The reason for that is that because FDA felt that as you increase the SPF, the level of protection in terms of the increase, the level of protection is not going to be significantly higher. It's relatively small in terms of the percentage. However, in a practical sense, many times patients, we all know, they underutilize sunscreen, and that includes probably many of us as physicians. Sunscreen is tested at 2 milligram per centimeter square, which translates to about 1 ounce to cover the total body surface. We know that most of us do not use sunscreen at that particular concentration. Multiple studies have shown that most individuals use sunscreen between 0.5 to 1 milligram per centimeter square. So automatically, the in-use SPF is going to be significantly lower than the label SPF. That is the reason for patients who are exquisitely photosensitive, for example, it does make sense to have higher SPF sunscreen so that they, when they underutilize the sunscreen, they still get a good level of protection. So that is the reason that FDA is seeking comment on this particular issue. They have not made a ruling as yet.
So you mentioned that for certain types of patients, a higher SPF above this questionable cap might be beneficial.
On the practical sense, it may be beneficial for some patients who are exquisitely sensitive to sunlight, taking into account that they may underutilize the sunscreen like many of us do. The other part that is important nowadays, I think FDA had recently made a ruling also about the broad spectrum claim. I think that is something that we all have to recognize so that patient can recognize also, because it's important for us to recommend sunscreen with appropriate SPF, usually 30 or above for most individuals. And also, we should recommend patients to look for sunscreen which is labeled as broad spectrum. For the longest period of time in the US, there have not been an FDA mandated testing for the UVA protection of sunscreen. But in 2011, they finally came out with a final rule on this particular issue. FDA now mandate that for sunscreens to be labeled as broad spectrum sunscreen, they have to pass an in vitro test, so-called critical wavelength. Critical wavelength test is defined as the 90% of the UV absorbance that would occur at that wavelength or below. So a sunscreen that is broad spectrum would have a critical wavelength of 370 or above. And that is the FDA standard. That is, you know, you have to be having a critical wavelength of 370 or above in order for the sunscreen to be labeled as broad spectrum sunscreen. Clearly, it has to be always combined with SPF, because one can essentially game this particular system by putting a lot of UVA filters in there, having relatively UVB filter. Because of that, the critical wavelength is going to be 370 or even higher than 370. That is not the type of sunscreen we want, because you want to have sunscreen that would protect against UVA, but also against UVB. So that's the reason that critical wavelength always has to be combined with the SPF.
You mentioned practicality issues in terms of the amount of sun protection that someone gets from a sunscreen. And I was wondering about the question of photolability of certain ingredients of these sunscreens and how they actually change, and if that could result in patients not getting the degree of protection that they theoretically should with a sunscreen.
Very, very good question. Indeed, some UV filters are very well known to be photolabile. The most classical example of that is avobenzone, which is the best actually long wave UVA filter that we have in the market here, because that is the only one that is approved by the FDA. However, in the past few years, to the credit of the sunscreen industry, most manufacturers have been able to photostabilize all the photo unstable filters by putting different combinations of sunscreen, or by putting other ingredients in there that would photostabilize, for example, the avobenzone. So even though it was an issue, it continued to be an issue if it is not properly photostabilized. Nowadays, for most of the major manufacturers, the photo instability is no longer a significant issue. By the way, that is the reason that I think there are new UV filters around in other parts of the world that has the main advantage to be UVA filter or UVB, UVA, broad spectrum filter, which are photostable.
Very interesting. So with all of these different options in terms of filters, do you find that your recommendations for sunscreens would be different depending on the type of patient in question? For example, some sunscreen filters might be contact allergens, so would that come into play? Or what about the demographic in terms of ethnic background or age of the patient? Does that make a difference?
It does. I do individualize the recommendation. There are several aspects that I take into account. One, for very, very young children, I usually recommend, assuming their epidermal barrier is intact, meaning they do not have atopic dermatitis or something like that. Assuming the epidermal barrier is intact, I would recommend to use titanium dioxide or zinc oxide containing sunscreen, the so-called inorganic UV filters, mainly because the absorption doesn't exist with those, so therefore it's very, very safe. For patients who complain about sensitivity to sunscreen, which, by the way, most commonly is due to the other inactive ingredient of sunscreen causing irritant dermatitis, I would recommend also titanium dioxide or zinc oxide containing sunscreen, mainly because they have been shown to be very inert, would not cause any type of allergic reaction. The most common photo contact allergen to sunscreen is oxybenzone, but even with that, actually the proportion or the percentage is very low, less than 5% of the patients who truly have photoallergic reaction to sunscreen. So the vast majority of patients who talked about or complained about sensitivity to sunscreen actually is because of irritant dermatitis from the vehicles. The other aspect that I do take into consideration is the skin type of the patient. Patients with darker skin type, generally they cannot tolerate, for cosmetic reason, sunscreen that contain a lot of titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, because no matter how well it is micronized, it would always leave a sort of whitish discoloration on the skin. So for many of these patients, they may not be able to use it on a regular basis. So I do recommend for them to use primarily chemical sunscreen with organic filters.
Very helpful, thank you. And what about this question that has come up in various circles regarding nanoparticles? Could you enlighten our listeners as to the debate and what your recommendations would be?
Nanoparticles always come up. A lot of patients, I'm certain for those of us who see patients on a regular basis, would ask about that. Nanoparticle is necessary to be used in many sunscreen because it acts synergistically with chemical filters to increase the SPF. So a lot of time it is used together. The nanoparticles, the concern of nanoparticles that had been raised is because nanoparticles, upon exposure to UV, can generate reactive oxygen species, and clearly that potentially could damage the cells on the skin. However, it should be kept in mind that the way nanoparticles is used in sunscreen, they are now very well coated. Because of that, the reactive oxygen species would not be generated from these nanoparticles. That's number one. Number two, the concern is that whether nanoparticles would get absorbed into the skin, into the dermis, and into the bloodstream. There are multiple studies that have shown now that nanoparticles, assuming the epidermal barrier is intact, stays on the superficial part of the skin. It does not get absorbed into the dermis. So it's perfectly safe to use nanoparticle-containing sunscreen as long as the skin is normal.
Now, Dr. Lim, you mentioned that as part of the testing protocol for sunscreens, erythema is measured. What about this question raised by some that the capability of sunscreens to minimize erythema may in some form mask potential damage that is still occurring in the skin?
Very good question. That question that is asked by some patients is because of the study that was published online, actually, in an animal model using an irritant contact dermatitis ear swelling model. What they did is that they used that particular model to evaluate the anti-inflammatory property of various UV filters that is used in sunscreens, and found that more than one half of the UV filters they tested had anti-inflammatory property suppressing the ear swelling. However, that particular study should be kept in mind that it is an animal model study. Number two, it is not an UV-induced inflammation model. It is a contact irritant dermatitis model. And thirdly, and very importantly, titanium dioxide and zinc oxide in this particular study also were shown to have anti-inflammatory property. We know that titanium dioxide and zinc oxide, both of them are very inert molecules that would not have any biologic effect. Our line is this, that if indeed this is proven in human, it has not been proven in human. Even if this is proven in human, we should recognize that all sunscreen have very, very good UV filters in there. It does protect our skin from various side effects of the sun. It would just indicate if indeed sunscreen does have anti-inflammatory property, and that is a big if in human being, it just indicates that the ability of sunscreen to decrease the UV-induced inflammation is because of the absorption and reflection of the photons, but also because of the anti-inflammatory property. It should not discourage us from encouraging patients to continue to use sunscreen and to practice for the protection, because in this particular case, the benefits has been very, very well established.
So you're saying that there may be a dual benefit of sunscreens?
If it is proven in human, there is a possibility. That's correct.
Thank you. And finally, another very hot topic of debate in the past several years has been the question of vitamin D, that the opposition to the recommendations of the Academy has largely taken this argument that if we protect our skin from the sun, we won't get enough vitamin D. And as an expert on light and photomedicine, what would be your answer to this?
It's a very complex issue, and it's a very, very good question. There are several aspects that one can look at it. It is definitely known that sunscreen, when it is applied at the appropriate concentration, 2 mg/cm², in a laboratory setting, would suppress the production of vitamin D secondary to exposure to, say, solar-stimulated radiation. However, multiple studies have shown now that the normal usage of sunscreen, which it indicate that most patients use it at less than 2 mg/cm², does not affect the vitamin D level. So the normal usage of sunscreen does not affect it. However, in patients who practice very rigorous photoprotection, which would mean that they would stay in the shade, they would use clothing, they use sunscreen, they use hats and so on and so forth. And those studies are pretty much done in patients who had significant photosensitivity, such as photosensitive lupus erythematosus, erythropoietic protoporphyria. Those group of patients, they do have lower level of vitamin D, inadequate level of vitamin D. So the normal usage of sunscreen is not associated with vitamin D insufficiency, but rigorous photoprotection can result in low level of vitamin D.
So what should be our recommendation for these patients?
For these patients, I think the recommendation would be if patients do significant rigorous photoprotection, there are two ways. One is that you can just tell them to take regular doses of vitamin D. The current recommendation is 600 international units per day for the average adult between the age of 1 to the age of 70. For patients who are older than 70, 800 international units per day. Or if you are concerned enough, if the patient is concerned enough, one can do vitamin D testing to see what the level is.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Lim. This has been most educational.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sunscreens protect against UVA and UVB, and the FDA standardizes sunscreen SPF, or sun protection factor, testing to ensure quality. Testing requires that skin is first coated with sunscreen at a concentration of 2 milligrams per centimeter squared, which correlates to using approximately 1 ounce of sunscreen for your entire body. Next, skin is subjected to UVA and UVB to produce erythema. The FDA has also determined that sunscreen can only be labeled as broad spectrum if it passes a critical wavelength test, and the FDA states that broad spectrum sunscreens will protect against both UVA and UVB. SPF predominantly covers UVB, thus it is important that broad spectrum sunscreen also has adequate SPF. The FDA is considering limiting SPF to values of 50 or below because SPF values above 50 produce small increases in efficacy. However, as the median concentration of sunscreen application is 0.5 milligrams per centimeter squared, individuals receive less sunscreen protection than is intended for a given SPF. Producing sunscreens with SPFs above 50 may ensure that highly photosensitive individuals still get adequate SPF. Sunscreen recommendations should be adjusted for individual patients. Dr. Lim recommends chemical sunscreens or those with organic filters for individuals with darker skin because sunscreens containing titanium dioxide or zinc oxide can produce mild discoloration. Titanium dioxide or zinc oxide containing sunscreens are recommended for children and individuals sensitive to sunscreen. Sunscreen use should be emphasized among children because only about 20% of children engage in photoprotective behaviors, and sunscreen use from an early age has been shown to reduce future incidences of skin cancer. Sunscreen use may elicit several concerns in physicians and patients. Individuals may be worried that a sunscreen's photolability will decrease sunscreen protection. However, ingredients that ensure photostability and efficacy are now added to sunscreens. Sunscreens also contain nanoparticles, which increase SPF. This may provoke concern because nanoparticles generate reactive oxygen species, or ROS, in response to UV exposure. However, nanoparticles in sunscreen are coated to inhibit ROS formation, and studies have also shown that nanoparticles do not cross the epidermis or enter the bloodstream. There is also concern that sunscreens may minimize erythema and mask skin damage. However, the anti-inflammatory effects of the UV filters in sunscreens have not been proven in humans, and Dr. Lim notes that sunscreen should still be used as it provides sun protection, even if sunscreen does have anti-inflammatory effects. Research shows that thicker applications of sunscreen correlate with decreased serum vitamin D levels. Sunscreen used at 2 milligrams per centimeter squared will decrease vitamin D production, but normal sunscreen usage concentrations have no negative implication on vitamin D production. It is also important to note that excessive photoprotection, as demonstrated by individuals with significant photosensitivities, i.e. photosensitive lupus erythematosus, may cause vitamin D deficiency. For these patients, it is recommended that individuals aged 1 to 70 take 600 IU of vitamin D per day, and individuals older than 70 take 800 IU of vitamin D per day. Vitamin D testing can also be done to ensure adequate vitamin D levels.